In the falling snow, a laughing boy holds out his palms until they are white. That's a haiku by African-American author Richard Wright, an example of the way this miniature Japanese poetic form has become a global phenomenon. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Many of us encounter haiku in grade school, a seemingly simple form with lines of five syllables, then seven syllables, and then back to five syllables that gives us the feeling anyone can be a poet. What are the origins of haiku? How does it embody Japanese culture? And why do we think of it as only about cherry blossoms and snow, and there are also examples of erotic, crude, and funny haiku? My guest is Adam Kern, professor of Japanese literature and visual culture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the editor of the recent anthology, The Penguin Book of Haiku. Welcome to University of the Air.
Nice to see you, Emily. Hi.
Can I start by asking you what drew you into this field of Japanese literature to begin with and visual culture? I'm always intrigued by what takes somebody into a particular area that then becomes their life work.
Well, the short answer is that I grew up in a small community in Minnesota. And when I was in high school, I had the opportunity to go to Japan as an exchange student, as a high school exchange student. And I never looked back. It was just an amazing experience. I fell in love with Japanese comic books, with Japanese novels, and with Japanese culture. And after thinking long and hard in college about different careers, I finally settled on Japanese literature.
And that was at Harvard?
No, I was actually at the University of Minnesota as my undergrad, and I was pre-med. And I decided maybe I don't want to go to medical school after all. And then I went to Harvard as a master's student, and I stayed for a while.
This project, to have the Penguin publishers come up with a brand new anthology of haiku seems like quite a coup to get them to come up with a new book about haiku that has, about 1,000 examples included in it? How did you come up with the idea that we need an anthology of haiku and get them to come out with this book?
I didn't. Actually, Penguin contacted me out of the blue and said that someone had recommended that I might be interested in doing a project like this. And I later learned that it was Jay Rubin, who was a former colleague of mine and is one of the key figures in modern Japanese literature and has done work with Penguin before. So I'm extremely grateful to Jay. But I got this curious email in my box from an editor at Penguin and said, we've heard about your work on translating puns and humor, and we think that you might be the right person to do the Penguin Book of Haiku, which we'd like to have in our lineup. Because believe it or not, even though most people might assume that there has always been a Penguin Book of Haiku, we don't have one. So I thought about it, and within about 30 minutes, I was so overcome by the prospect that I wrote up a proposal saying, yes, I'll absolutely do it. However, I have to be very clear that what most people think of as haiku is not the haiku that I'm going to be writing about in the Penguin book. Because as a scholar of pre-modern Japan, I know that the myth of haiku as being a Japanese Zen nature poetry is terribly misguided. So if I'm going to do the project, you have to let me write about all sorts of different kinds of verses that have largely been written out of the mythology of the haiku. And these things include satirical verses. They include cheeky verses. Silly verses.
Body. I was kind of, as I read through the anthology, there's some pretty shocking ones in there in terms of the content and the language.
Absolutely. And I think that that has been whitewashed out of this grand narrative of haiku that the Japanese and people around the world have told themselves for a variety of reasons. And so that was something that I wanted to reclaim. And Penguin got back to me and said, well, we'll think about it. This is certainly not what we expected. And after a couple of weeks, they said, well, we'll do it on your terms. You can have carte blanche to write about what you want, including the naughty words that you'd like to use in the volume.
Well, you write in the introduction to this Penguin Anthology about kind of coming up with a definition of haiku and how what we think it is, as you mentioned, isn't necessarily what it came to be or how it was used, and even how the poet most associated with it didn't even write haiku. So that's kind of a paradox.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think when I ask students or just general people about their impressions of haiku, very often they say, oh, it's an ancient form of Japanese Zen nature poetry that is about cherry blossoms and harvest moons and the like. It has to be in 17 syllables. It has to have a season word, and it has to be unrhymed. And pretty much all of those points are questionable, if not untrue.
So why do we have that as our kind of gold standard of haiku then?
Right. I think there are complex reasons, but essentially there were two moments in the history of Japanese poetry that have led us down this road. And the first was in the 1890s when a literary and national modernizer by the name of Masaoka Shiki, who's actually one of the four so-called grandmasters of haiku, decided that if the Japanese were going to modernize and westernize, they had to abandon this kind of groupthink that was in the arts essentially perpetuating a kind of composition that was a group collaborative composition. And Shiki reasoned that in the West, modern individuals do things on their own. They think on their own. They write poetry that expresses their own ideas outside of a group. And that just wasn't the case in Japan. Most artistic and cultural production always acknowledged a collaborative context. And so Shiki decided that what he was going to do in order to modernize Japanese literature was to make the rhetorical claim that Basho, who was a 17th century poet of group poetry, essentially that Basho was writing individualistic poetry that the Japanese could take pride in and then use as a base for proceeding into the 20th century as individuals. Now, Basho never wrote haiku in his life. And the reason that I say that is because he wrote a kind of collaborative linked poetry where one poet composes half of a larger verse, and then the other poet, the following poet, composes a reply. So let's say that I were to say to you, Emily, roses are red, violets are blue.
Right.
Then that's essentially the first half of a poem. Shiki took that first half out of context and claimed that that was the individual standalone kind of poetry that the Japanese could use to modernize. So Basho was never thinking in those terms. He was thinking of this poetic word game where people would sit around, sometimes with little cups of sake, and sort of trade witticisms through the medium of this linked poetry.
What does the term haiku mean in Japanese? I mean, why is it called that?
Well, so Shiki coined the term haiku in the 1890s. Prior to that, this linked poetry had two forms. One was called renga, or serious linked poetry, that goes back to about the 8th century in Japan. And probably in the 16th, 17th century, the rules of the compositional rules of renga were lessened. They were made a lot more simple so that anybody could participate. And a new form of linked poetry called witty linked poetry, or haikai no renga, evolved. And that's what Basho was writing, was this sort of lighthearted linked poetry that if we were to think of modern analogs, I might say that the renga, the serious linked poetry, was like opera, and then the witty linked poetry was like hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a complete relaxing of the rules and an opening up of the diction. And when Shiki was trying to go back and find this model for individualism, he settled on the very first verse of Haikai no Renga, which he abbreviated to Haikai no Renga no Ku, or a verse of lightly or wittily linked poetry. So haiku literally means light verse.
Hmm. Okay. And is there, can you give us an example of a haiku that you include in your anthology that you think is a good example where you know it's haiku, it fits the definition that you're looking for or something? Give us an example.
Okay, so the example that you want is of a modern haiku, or do you want something that is a haikai no renga no ku, part of this witty linked?
Oh, gosh, I'll take both.
Okay, so actually probably the most famous verse in Japanese haiku history is one by Basho about a frog plunging into a pond. And my translation is, old pond, a frog plunges into water sound. So that verse was taken by Shiki and others and presented as an individual standalone poetry. And I think that if you were to ask most people to identify one haiku, this would probably be it.
Can you read it one more time?
Okay. Old pond, a frog plunges into water sound.
I was thinking, because you write it at one point, that the haiku might be considered the microcosmic means of imbuing life's tiny moments with titanic meaning. But I'm trying to think, what is the titanic meaning behind that frog?
Right.
Jumping
so,
into the pond.
So this, that definition is essentially for modern haiku.
Okay.
And the fact that it's difficult to find that in this poem actually is evidence that what I'm saying about Basho not having mm-hmm. written haiku is true.
So his is more like a picture, like a frozen moment in time, would you say?
Or well,
like an image?
Okay. So my explanation is that this poem has very often been interpreted as supporting the Zen nature model of haiku.
And can you give us a brief little Zen?
Right. So the idea here is that Zen is a sect of Buddhism that tries to point people to leading lives that are in the present moment by getting them to understand that words are not actually experience, that words are a covering of experience. So very often in Zen Buddhism, there are these riddles called koan, and I'm sure that all of our listeners have actually heard of some of these, whether or not they knew that they were actually this Japanese Zen Buddhist riddle. An example would be the proverbial, if a tree falls in the woods and nobody is there to hear it, is there a sound?
Mm-hmm.
And the mind boggles at that because, of course, you know, we think that there would be a sound because if a large tree falls in the woods. But the point of the question is to say, if there's no human ear to hear the sound, can we actually speak of it as a sound? Or what is the sound mm-hmm. of one hand clapping? So these are the kinds of Zen riddles that have been used to interpret this poem. And the reading of this verse is something along the lines of this. Well, the old pond has been around for an eternity. And we realize that it's been around, but it takes a very young, green little frog, probably in spring, so this is a verse about spring, to jump in and to disrupt the placidity of the surface to remind us of how old the pond is. So there's a dialectic relationship between the young frog and the old pond that if you are interested in Zen Buddhism, this makes perfect sense and can lead people to enlightenment. In my humble opinion, mm-hmm. that's mumbo-jumbo. So,
I don't know, it sounded kind of good to me.
Well, this is the prevailing analysis of this poem. Uh-huh. I mean, there are variations on this theme. But it's likely that in Basho's day, this is not really what was going on. And point of fact, from the very beginning of Japanese poetics, one of the most famous statements was that human beings compose poetry naturally, just the way that birds sing and frogs croak. So for 1,000 years in Japanese poetry, every time you had a frog in a poem, it croaked. For the first time, Basho withholds the croak and instead gives us a splash. So this is the essentially the 17th century of a banana peel, of someone walking along, and instead of getting what everybody expects, they slip on this and into the pond plunges the frog. Now, what's interesting about this, and I'm pretty sure that most of your readers might find this surprising, is that because this was just the first half of a poem, we actually know what the second half of the poem was. And it was written by one of Basho's disciples, Takarai Kikaku, and the response to Basho's poem was, "On young leaves of rush hangs a spider's web." And I'll read that one more time. Mm-hmm. On young leaves of rush hangs a spider web. So in Basho's day, he was not composing an individual poem that was meant to express his individuality and that later would be interpreted according to, you know, Zen Buddhist principles. That's not what he was about. He was composing a poem that was meant to be responded to. And we have a record of the people sitting around in the room who were composing this sort of collaborative verse. And that's the response to Basho's poem.
I also have to marvel at your job as translator, or anyone's job as translator, because it's hard enough even going from a similar language, like going from German or Italian into English, but to go from Japanese to English, to go from the kinds of characters into English in poetry, when there's so much emphasis on the sound of words and the relationship between different kinds of words, I just don't know how you would do it without going insane.
Well, you're assuming that I wasn't insane to begin with to have taken on this project. Yes, Japanese is very different from English. In fact, Chinese is much more similar to English than Chinese is to Japanese because both Chinese and English are subject-verb-object languages, so the grammar is very similar. True, Chinese has tones. Japanese doesn't. It's very flat. There are no stresses in Japanese. But written Japanese is perversely difficult. It mobilizes Chinese characters and then its own two syllabaries, which are essentially phonetic systems of representing sound, and then mixes all of these things. It's kind of like if we didn't have our alphabet and all of a sudden Greeks gave us their writing, or maybe Russians gave us their writing, and we were using Russian script with different scripts to represent English. It would be a real mess, and that's what the Japanese have. So there are challenges both grammatically and in terms of the writing systems. And unfortunately, there are very few Japanese words that are similar to English words, that pun the same way or that express the same kind of mindset. So what I do is to do the best that I can with what I have and come up with creative responses. But to be honest, I'm a really bad translator. In fact, I hate to confess this, but I probably translated about 10,000 verses and selected the 1,000 that were the least bad for this volume. So if you saw some of my belly flops, you would know that what I'm saying is really true. There are people who can translate haiku beautifully off the cuff. I'm not one of them. I have to really sort of dig in and think about it and write and rewrite and polish.
I kind of doubt that Penguin would have had you do this anthology if they thought that. Knowing what you do about that poem that you shared about the frog in the pond, what do we miss by not hearing it in Japanese? You know, what is untranslatable about that? Or maybe there's another example that you have of a poem where when we hear it in English, we just can't get the heart of it.
Right. So I think that I said that there are a number of myths about Japanese haiku, and one of them is that it's unrhymed. I think that that is true when elementary school students are learning haiku. Basically, the teachers say, just concentrate on counting to 5, 7, and 5, right? And don't worry about rhyming. Don't worry about anything else, about nature words or anything like that. However, if you think about it, Japanese only has 6 possible ways of ending a word. So there are 5 vowel sounds in Japanese, a, i, u, e, o, and 1 consonant, n. So that's 6. And if there are 17 syllables in a haiku, then it's impossible to actually not rhyme somehow. So rhyme actually exists in haiku, and it exists Not in terms of n-rhyme, because with only six final sounds, n-rhyme never posed much of a challenge. Therefore, the kinds of rhyme that haiku tend to have in Japanese are internal. They're alliterative, they're internal rhyme, and trying to capture that in English is extremely challenging. And I'll read a poem in a second, but I just wanted to add here that when Shiki devised his model of haiku in the 1890s, he actually had Western photography on his mind. And he was thinking that if we Japanese are going to modernize and Westernize, what we need to do is look to scientific objectivity as well as individualism. So Shiki tended to pick verses that could be represented in the emerging field, in terms of the emerging field of photography. And so that's why we have this notion in modern Japan and outside of Japan that haiku is all about some kind of experiential snapshot.
Yeah, it almost seems as if you take a moment and it's forever frozen, that we can imagine whether it's that frog about to jump in or something else that it captures that moment. I'd like to hear a poem in Japanese right, and then a translation into English, and we'll do that in a moment when we continue with University of the Air. Till the very blossoms become a pain in the neck. That's an example of a haiku included in the Penguin Book of Haiku, edited by my guest, Adam Kern. I'm Emily Auerbach, and we're back talking about this global phenomenon, haiku. We were just talking about the problem of translation. To go from a Japanese poem that is somehow integrally part of the Japanese culture to a few words in English has to be quite a Herculean task. Can you give us an example of a haiku that you include, how it sounds in Japanese, and then what you did with it to give it to us in English?
Sure. There are a lot of really great verses in Japanese that I fail miserably at translating into English, and especially in terms of capturing the sounds. But this particular one by Busson, who's another one of the four grandmasters of haiku, is one that I think I didn't fail that miserably at. So I'll read the English first, then the Japanese, and then I'll read them again.
Oh, that'd be great.
Okay. So my English translation is this: bottomless pail, thrashed along by a field threshing late autumn gale. I'll read that one more time. Bottomless pail, thrashed along by a field threshing late autumn gale.
And the pail is P-A-I-L?
Yes, it's P-A-I-L.
A bottomless pail.
Right, a bottomless pail, thrashed along by a field threshing late autumn gale. And I'm trying to capture the rhythms of the Japanese.
And you've got the rhyme with the pail and the gale,
right,
and
exactly.
So on.
Yeah. And so here's the Japanese. Soko no nai oke koke aruku no waki kana. I'll read that one more time. Soko no nai oke koke aruku no waki kana. So it has the same kind of cadences and hard sounds and bumpy rhythm that suggests a pail being, you know, sort of blown along the ground by the wind. So that's an example of something that doesn't fail that miserably.
Yeah, it's very beautiful. And I guess one question I have for you is we always think of Japanese culture in terms of miniatures, whether it's the bonsai garden or, in the case of haiku, this idea that you can take something so small and make it exquisite and sort of microcosmic that and very sort of understated. Is that why we link haiku to Japanese culture so much, is because it is that sort of epitome of the miniature?
Right. So I did say that there were two important moments in the history of haiku that have sort of distorted our understanding, and the first one came in the 1890s. The second one really came after the Second World War. And I think that the Japanese, in trying to abuse themselves of this reputation as being warmongering militarists, tried to present themselves as Zen, peace-loving, you know, poets. And so when haiku began to be spread throughout the world after the Second World War, something else was actually happening as well, and that was the so-called Japanese economic miracle, where Japan went from being a completely destroyed country to an increasingly strong economic power that eventually peaked at number two, although in recent years, of course, it's been surpassed by China. During the 60s and 70s, as I'm sure you don't remember because you were too young at that point, the Japanese were famous for taking things like radios and miniaturizing them. So I think that this notion of the haiku as representing the Japanese, an innate Japanese genius for miniaturization, is actually very much tied up with this self-serving narrative of the Japanese, you know, globalizing and becoming an economic power.
You mean this idea that if you are writing a tiny poem about cherry blossoms, you must be a peaceful people? Is that what you're saying?
Right, from the Japanese perspective. So when they presented the haiku on the world stage, they got rid of all of the irreverent verse, all of the dirty sexy verse, all of the other stuff, and only selected the verses that presented Japan in this positive light. And from the American perspective, we wanted to see in the Japanese ourselves. We wanted to see how we were contributing to the resuscitation of the Japanese economy and the Japanese culture. And the economic miracle, it was a very potent symbol of that. So that's why I think that we tend to see this tendency in Japanese arts toward miniaturization, because it fits in with this economic revival myth that we have.
And the reason that in your own anthology for Penguin, you went back a bit and put in the anthology some poems that don't fit our stereotype is because you're trying to kind of not give us the anglicized expected version, but something that was older and deeper than that.
That's right. There are approximately 2,000 to 3,000 books in English on haiku, or including haiku. And I would say that about 98% of them relish in this myth that haiku are just Zen nature poems. And to actually go historically back, if you walk into a bookstore in Tokyo and see any of the old books, the Zen nature poetry stuff is almost not non-existent. It's almost not there. Instead, it's all this other stuff that's in the anthology, the dirty, sexy stuff, which I think of as essentially overtly comic verse with its pants down.
Almost like limericks a little bit.
Yeah, I think they probably are a lot dirtier than some of the dirty limericks.
I know we can't read all of them on the air. Some of the ones that you have in your anthology wouldn't pass the censor test. The one that I open this part with, "The gaze I shall, till the very blossoms become a pain in the neck." Even just to find a phrase like a pain in the neck in a haiku seems different than what we would expect.
Right. And that's, again, because our the general tendency is to view haiku as a form of highbrow poetry, but in its day it was much more analogous to rap or hip-hop. It used colloquial diction, it was irreverent, it was goofy, and it broke from the highbrow poetry of centuries past.
So let's say it was a haiku and you include some in the anthology about a widow and orgasms and this and that.
That's a great poem.
Yeah.
So that's a very good example of a dirty, sexy verse. And the verse runs something like this: "Plying fingers as though he were at hand, the widow's orgasm." And that, of course, on the surface seems to be incredibly dirty. And that's exactly the kind of verse that would have been cut out and whitewashed from the mythology of the haiku. But I think it's really an interesting verse for a couple of reasons. The first is because it identifies a very human feature, which is just because someone's husband dies and therefore, you know, one is supposed to be chaste and become essentially a secular nun, doesn't mean that one ceases to long for him or to have human desires.
Yeah, and there's a poignancy there in terms of just capturing the grief and loneliness.
There is. But also, it's an incredibly cheeky verse because it's almost a word-for-word parody of a famous passage from the Confucian Analects. Confucius, of course, was Chinese, but Confucianism was one of the major systems of thought in Japan for a very long time. And so the original passage in the Analects is about worshiping the ancestors of the dead. If you think of them, then they become very present. So it's a brilliant poem, even though it is, as I say, a dirty, sexy verse.
I will say that I as I was reading through the haiku that you include in the anthology, I almost felt like I wasn't sure how to do that because normally, let's say you're reading Shakespeare sonnets, at least you have 14 lines and you have kind of a contained thing and then you turn a page, you get another sonnet. In this case, because it's only 17 syllables for the most part, just three lines, we have one, then we go on to the next one and the next one and there are these, it feels so choppy in a sense that it's hard to know how to read them. Do you open the book and point your finger and read one?
Well, people are certainly able to do that, and there are essentially two ways that I can think of answering this. One is that I actually did order the verses in this book to tell a larger story, and because if originally haiku was this collaborative game where one poet made a verse and then another poet responded, there was kind of a conversation among the different verses. So I try to do that in this anthology. So if you go to the first poem and read all the way to the last poem, you can see that there's kind of a stream of consciousness-like flow among the verses. And that actually took me probably a longer time to arrange the verses than it did to translate them.
And would you say, kind of taking the global view of that, if you look at the entirety of what you have here, what is the story about humanity that emerges? And how much of it is uniquely Japanese? How much of it is universal?
Right. So I think that the uniquely Japanese part is the idea of Shiki's idea of trying to respond to the West in a Japanese way using Japanese material, that ability, that willingness to modify one's own culture to meet the demands of another culture, I think that part is one of the major features of Japanese culture, although it's not unique to Japan. I mean, I think most cultures adapt and modify. But I also think the language is obviously uniquely Japanese, although then again, the Japanese have adopted Chinese, and there are even some Western words in some of the poems that I include in the anthology. But generally speaking, the language is Japanese, but the topics are not specifically uniquely Japanese. They're universal, and that's what makes a lot of this poetry, I feel, really worth reading. There's a verse or two, for example, about nepotism and about corruption at the highest levels of government that many of us might be thinking about these days, regardless of one's political affiliation. And I'll just read two. This is by an unnamed author, and it goes like this. The bureaucrats tot. Learns about grabby-grabby an awful lot. The bureaucrat's tot learns about grabby-grabby an awful lot. And the awful lot pun in Japanese also exists, where it's not just a tremendous amount, but the idea is that this child is going to suffer a terrible fate by being the son or the daughter of a bureaucrat.
And the poem that you were looking at in Japanese, the equivalent of grabby grabby, was there something in Japanese that made it sound like a child's kind?
Yeah, the word nigi nigi in Japanese is a child's word, and it's sometimes parents use it for a child grasping at things. Like if you put your finger in a one-year-old or a two-year-old's hand, a Japanese parent might say nigi nigi. And so that's a child's word that puts us in the perspective of the child in this poem viewing the corrupt actions of his or her parent, who's a corrupt official. So I mean, I try to match the tone and the cadence of the original. I do the translations. So here's the other one that I really like. It's by Gosei. One shadow reaching the ceiling of rank breaks bad. And that, to me, just seems pretty much like a universal, that in any culture, at any time, there are people, not everybody in government, of course, because there are a lot of good people, but there are people who, when they reach the absolute height of power, somehow it twists them or it distorts them in some profound way. You know, power corrupts. It's that idea.
I think I remember reading, I think in your introduction, that at some points haiku was banned.
Yes.
Tell me about that. Well, I'm just thinking that because you're talking about politics and corruption and, you know.
Yeah. So haiku was actually banned for several reasons. And one had to do with the fact that the government didn't really want the samurai class to participate in this kind of hip-hop, essentially, this kind of lowbrow poetry. There were other highbrow forms of poetry that the government felt were more appropriate to the ruling elite of Japan prior to the 20th century. And so the government forbade samurai from composing haiku, from attending haiku parties, which is pretty radical, right? The second reason that haiku was banned was because it became widespread in Japan through a kind of poetry competition that was very close to a kind of sweepstakes scam or a lottery scam. And essentially what judges would do would be to issue a challenge verse, and then they would have readers from all around the country writing in with their response. This has always reminded me a little bit of the cartoon captioning contest for the New Yorker. You know, the New Yorker publishes those cartoons without a caption, and then thousands of readers write in, and then it used to be Bob Mankoff, and people at the New Yorker would select, you know, the winning caption. So the thing is that these judges would charge a small entry fee. So people would write in with their winning haiku in response to another verse, and they would, most of the time, they would not win, right? In some of these contests, you would have tens of thousands of people sending in maybe the equivalent of about $8 per poem. So the winners would actually get these grand prizes.
So it was the jackpot.
It might be around $10,000, the equivalent of $10,000 or $20,000 in gold or silk or some such.
Some skimmed off the top?
Well, the judges kept the rest. I mean, some of the money went to pay the printing costs. I mean, these prompts were printed up in woodblock printing and then circulated around the country. And the people who were doing the circulating also took a cut of it as well. But the judges themselves became fabulously rich. And so the government essentially—
Grabby-grabby,
that's right. So the government essentially felt that this was a kind of scam. And so they outlawed this haiku contest. But it was actually this kind of contest that spread haiku nationally in Japan back in the late 17th, early 18th centuries. So if it had not been for this contest, it's possible that we wouldn't be speaking about haiku today.
That's interesting that it became a national craze. We're going to talk about, are there women writers of haiku, and some other examples of more modern haiku when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. First childbirth, the husband feeling he himself did half the labor. 75 days of postpartum abstention up the wazoo. His wife, who once had caught his eye, now gets up his nose. That's three examples of haiku included in the Penguin Book of Haiku, edited by my guest, Adam Kern. I'm Emily Auerbach. We're back talking about haiku and its many forms. Before the break, I mentioned that in your introduction, you talk about women as writers of haiku. I know in a lot of other cultures, there were so many pressures against women, telling them to be silent, making it so they would have to take male pen names to get past a publisher, like George Eliot or George Sand or the Bronte sisters, or publishing anonymously. What kinds of circumstances were there in Japan for a woman who wanted to be a writer?
Well, that's a great question. There's a very interesting history in Japan because during the heyday of poetic composition at court, and I'm thinking right now about the 11th and the 12th centuries, arguably the greatest poets were all women. And Japanese poetry had just as many women greats as men. Something happened, though, when Confucianism came into Japan with its denigration of women, its sort of elevation of men for many centuries. And in the early days of the witty-linked verse in Japan, meaning the 16th and 17th centuries, there were very few women who were actually participating in this collaborative word game. But things started changing in the 18th century for a variety of reasons. There was a sort of outpouring of urban commoner culture during this time, and women were included in this movement. So what we get in the heyday of haiku during the 18th and 19th centuries is an outpouring of women poets. It's impossible to actually figure out a percentage, but my rough guesstimate would be that anywhere from 25% to 33% of the poets were women, which is pretty astounding if we compare Japan to other cultures mm-hmm. at that time. Women sat together with men in many of these collaborative sessions, and also, very importantly, there were people from all sorts of different social classes. And this was also something that the government did not like, for samurai to be sitting together with commoners and men and women and people of various backgrounds.
Too democratic.
Too demotic, that's right. There were people in the 20th century, Japanese scholars, American scholars, who have written about the or who have traced the origins of civil society in Japan back to these haiku collaborative contexts. The thinking being that this was really the first time in Japan that such a democratic or demotic group was assembled. And that became the basis, these scholars argue, for the rise of civil society in Japan much earlier than in other Asian cultures.
With women writing a fairly hefty percentage of the poetry, do you find some of the subjects that are included would be what we might call feminist? In other words, that they get across some of the ideas about restrictions against women or kind of are asserting their own authority as women?
I wouldn't necessarily go that far. I would say that very often there were verses that poked holes in the superiority of male dominance. There are a number of verses about the master of the house winning fights but ending up boiling the rice because he didn't really win the fight. The authors of these verses might have been women. They might also have been men. We're not entirely sure. So one of the verses that I include in my introduction provides this kind of ambiguity and also allows us to see the world from a woman's perspective. It's a little crude in its language, so just to warn your listeners, but the verse runs like this. The piece of ass slapped by mistake sends love letters. I'll read that one more time. The piece of ass slapped by mistake sends love letters. So we can imagine that maybe in a marketplace or some other public square, a man is walking along and sees a beautiful woman. Maybe he thinks he recognizes her. Maybe he doesn't. He slaps her behind, and she turns around, and he's shocked because he no longer is interested in her for one reason or another. But she actually, it turns out, has her own feelings and is interested in him. And because she's been given this kind of insulting sexual attention, or I should say in spite of this insulting sexual attention, she actually decides to pursue him.
Ooh, there must be something wrong with me because I would rather see her slap him back right in the face, not send a love letter to someone who had done something degrading.
Right, and that's what I'm saying, that this isn't a full-on feminist response according to the way that we think today or since mm-hmm. the 60s and 70s. But for the times, this probably was pretty radical, that a woman could initially be treated as a sex object and then to turn the tables and to turn the man into a sex object. So I think that that's the idea animating this poem.
One thing that I was struck by that you mentioned in your introduction as well is just how, I guess, how built into Japanese culture the haiku form is, to the point where even the Hello Kitty,
right.
Which we're all familiar with, that thing that it has 17 brush strokes as a way of kind of echoing the 17 syllables of a haiku.
Right. So this is just an observation or speculation on my part, but during the 70s and 80s, when Japanese corporations were trying to market to a global audience, they needed to devise some kind of pictorial trademark that didn't have any writing on it that could be used to send products to all sorts of different countries and yet somehow still symbolize Japanese-ness. So my speculation is that when the crafter of Hello Kitty for Sandio Corporation was devising it, she used 17 brushstrokes in order to signify the haiku, which of course was associated with Japan.
And most people would have picked up on that?
I don't know if they would have or not, but this is just something that I couldn't help notice because I've always wondered, why is it that Hello Kitty is always written with exactly 17 brushstrokes?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You do include a few black and white illustrations in the anthology from woodcuts and other things. Was there sort of a tendency to publish haiku with illustrations? In other words, let's say that one on the frog jumping into the pond, or the traditional kind that we might think of with cherry blossoms or autumn leaves. Were there publications of haiku that had illustrations to go along with each one?
The answer is yes. And in point of fact, from the early 17th century on, the Japanese had woodblock printing technology that was used to mass produce all sorts of literature. And in Japan, there was always a tendency to include images and illustrations in just about everything. So we can see how the Japanese took to doing modern Japanese comics or manga very readily. But if we go back to the time period, there were, of course, collections of poetry that consisted only of poetry. But there were also a lot of collections that existed almost in comic book form that had poems sprinkled across the page with little doodles or sort of cartoonish images that were related to the particular verses that were being reprinted.
Can you talk about haiku now? In other words, is it a living art form in Japan that if you did a Penguin anthology 20 years from now, you'd have a lot of new and exciting developments in the form? Or has it become a bit formulaic because of the sort of global awareness of it?
Well, haiku continues on around the world in many guises, and the short answer is that the traditionalist view of haiku, that it needs to have 17 syllables and be unrhymed and be about Zen nature topics, thankfully that view is relatively restricted to people who don't really produce a lot of haiku. I mean, there are books that conform to that traditionalist view, but most of the haiku that's being produced in Japan, in the States, in the UK, and elsewhere does not conform to that. It's actually much closer to the whimsicality and the experimentalism and the fun of the haiku historically in Japan, as I hope that many of the verses that we've been talking about today have illustrated, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the school marm traditionalist version of haiku that still holds a lot of people back from trying their hand at haiku, fortunately, is on its way out. And that was really one of the things that I was interested in pursuing in this book, was making the point that today haiku can be much more experimental and fun than the school marm traditionalist vision of haiku would have it.
And because it's so short, we definitely can memorize some of them, and it feels as if you can, it can be contained. You can hold it in your hand in a way that sometimes a longer epic poem, you can't kind of wrap your thinking around it. Do you have a favorite?
A favorite haiku?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have one favorite. It's a little bit like asking a parent with 20 kids if he or she has a favorite kid. But there are many verses that I really love and that stay with me. And I can think of a couple right now. One is Basho's verse about, he has these synesthetic moments where he mixes the senses. And one or two of those would be darkening seas, the call of a mallard, faintly white. Darkening seas, the call of a mallard, faintly white. And another one of his synesthetic verses is this. Lightning flash, penetrating the darkness, a night heron's cry. Lightning flash, penetrating the darkness, a night heron's cry. And I love that because when you hear the word lightning flash, you immediately expect that you're going to be seeing something, mm-hmm. but instead we don't get vision, we get the sound of the night heron. So there's this wonderful synesthetic blending.
And I'm automatically picturing the two birds as you're reading. It's interesting how the visual comes right along with what's being written about.
Yeah.
And let me ask you, what would we miss if we didn't have haiku in the world? It's a real brief elevator answer.
Well, I think we wouldn't have this model both for minimalism, because I think that haiku is the very definition of minimalism, but also a model for collaborative composition, because ultimately, historically, haiku was always collaborative.
Great. Well, thanks for collaborating with me today on the program. It's been very interesting. My guest has been Adam Kern. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.